In February 1993, Helen Knopfs and her 9-year-old son Derek both picked serial killer Tom Dillon out of a lineup as the man that they'd seen 2 years before, after he'd driven his car into a ditch while speeding away from the game area where, just minutes before, two deer hunters had been murdered. But FBI agent Harry Trombitis does not believe it was actually Tom Dillon that the witnesses saw that day.
I thought I'd run through some of the cars with you that we had. Dillon, the first three homicides, he used a blue pickup truck. We know that he had a pickup before this red one. The thing I wanted to point out that I thought was interesting when we talk about the Kalamazoo case is one of the witnesses had said that she saw a dark vehicle, like sort of a hatchback. Dillon didn't. He never owned a hatchback.
The relevant question here, though, is not what kind of car Tom Dillon drove, because the man in the ditch told Helen Knopfs he'd been driving his wife's car that day.
He also had another vehicle, and it was a Chevy Cavalier, and this is predominantly his wife's car.
When Susan and Jacinda interviewed Agent Trombitis in Columbus, Ohio, he brought with him pictures of the car that had belonged to Tom Dillon's wife, Kathy. These photos, he said, showed that the car Helen and Derek saw in the ditch could not have belonged to Tom Dillon or his wife.
But she did remember the driver saying, "This is my wife's car." And this, you know how they have the vehicle identification books?
Mm-hmm.
This was what she picked out from that book, which looks very much like the Chevy Cavalier.
Well, that certainly is not a hatchback.
It's not a hatchback.
Yeah.
That was a...
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what to say. I mean, that... I just know what he told us.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 14 of The State vs. Jeff Titus. My name is Robbie Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In 1990, Helen Knopfs had been asked to flip through a book of cars to try and identify the ditch car, and she'd ended up picking out a 1987 Dodge Shadow as a close match. Though the Shadow, she said, was slightly different from the car she'd seen. A Shadow has taillights that curved around its sides, but the ditch car's taillights had been flat along its back end. A 1988 Chevy Cavalier, like the one that belonged to Tom Dillon's wife, is very similar in shape to a Dodge Shadow. But unlike a Shadow, a Cavalier's taillights don't curve around its sides. And Kathy Dillon's Cavalier was dark gray, consistent with the description from Helen and Derek, the car was between blue and black in color.
You know, again, I have absolutely no information that Dillon had that kind of car.
His wife's car is a pretty close match.
Well, I don't know. You know, you're talking about the original thing was that it was a hatchback.
Well, there was more than... Helen's not the only one who saw the car.
Okay.
There were several people who saw the car who described it as...
A Monza, usually.
Chevy Monza, which is basically a Chevy Cavalier.
No one else. No, you're telling me something I didn't know.
Yeah, no one else.
Okay, well, again, this is all new information. I've heard hatchback before.
A Chevy Cavalier Coupe is definitely not a hatchback, which is how Helen had described the ditch car. But in the statement that Helen gave to investigators back in 1990, it's clear that when she called it a hatchback, what she'd meant, in fact, is the car had a short, abrupt trunk section, just like a Shadow, or a Cavalier. Now, technically, the term for this style is a notchback, not a hatchback, which is why investigators never realized that the car that Helen had seen was just about an exact match for the kind of car that Tom Dillon could have been driving on November 17, 1990. Because even though the Chevy Cavalier had been primarily his wife's car, Dillon had regularly driven the Cavalier on his long weekend drives. It had gotten better gas mileage. And the Cavalier is the car that Tom Dillon says he was driving in April of 1989, when he shot and killed Donald Welling, his first known victim.
Were you still in the video?
Yeah, he thought I was just in his office and talked to him or something on his open fire.
Did you talk to him?
No, he said something to me. He said, what's up? He just turned like that and he said, what's up? And I just shot him, killed him.
Although we've been able to obtain thousands of pages of records related to the Ohio serial sniper case, there are still lots of case materials that we have not yet been able to find. And one of the records I've been most interested in for over a year now is the videotape confession that Tom Dillon gave to the task force shortly before he pled guilty to 5 counts of murder. We couldn't find that video anywhere, though. Every agency we tried said that their copy of the tape was missing or destroyed. And then, 2 weeks ago, one of Dillon's attorneys went searching through his archives, just in case, and he found it. The old VHS tape that was used to record Dillon's confession.
Very remorseful.
And if you're wondering why we did not release an episode last week, that's why. I found out last Friday that the tape had been located and decided that we needed to see whatever was on it before we released our final episode on Tom Dillon. And now that we finally have that video, I finally have the answer to the question that's been on my mind ever since I learned about Tom Dillon. What questions had Dillon been asked about the Kalamazoo murders? And what did he have to say about them?
You're already aware of these things, but I want to ask you point blank. No responsibility whatsoever for any homicides in Michigan. How about Indiana?
No.
Okay.
How about Pennsylvania?
No.
Yep, that's it. That's all of it. That's the full extent of recorded questioning that Dillon received about the Kalamazoo murders.
When the Kalamazoo cold case team reopened the investigation into the Fulton Game area murders in 2000, that would have been the perfect time to re-examine whether Tom Dillon was a viable suspect in the case after all. Because in 2000, Tom Dillon was still alive. The cold case team could have tried to interview Dillon for themselves and get answers from him directly. But no attempts to speak to Dillon were ever made.
Did you know about the serial killer, that there was a guy who was a serial killer who'd been looked at?
No, I did not. No, I mean, this is interesting.
You don't know anything about the serial killer?
No. Fill me in.
When the Red Marble documentary team asked cold case detectives Brown and Workema about Dillon, they both said that was the first time they'd heard anything about a serial killer being a potential suspect in the case. They said they had no idea the two witnesses had ID'd a serial killer as a man who'd been seen fleeing from the scene of the crime. In fact, they had no idea there had ever even been a serial killer who targeted hunters.
Sure, it's curious, but you understand the setting was, it was the second day of deer season. Everybody in that field was armed with a firearm. A serial killer is no way going to go into that field, look for somebody to kill. That's not going to happen. He's not going to go into a field full of armed people and pick two out and shoot them. Not going to happen.
He actually did do that a week before. He killed a hunter the week before. And a week after, he did the same thing again.
Killed hunters. Well, I didn't know that, see. Well, that's, he's a crazy son of a gun. Yeah, but I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. We got the killer in jail.
One week after the Fulton Gay Maria murders, Jamie Paxton had been shot and killed while bow hunting in Belmont County. And 11 days before the Fulton Gay Maria murders, Kevin Loring was killed while deer hunting in Muskingum County during Ohio's gun season. In his confession, Dylan told the task force that on the day he killed Kevin Loring, he started out by looking for deer to hunt.
Looked up on the right, I saw him standing up there, stopped my truck, jumped out, walked up in the woods. He was headed that way. He started coming, you know, I waited there 10 minutes or so, a few minutes or so. He came over the hill and started coming toward me.
Dylan claimed that he'd never set out intending to commit murder. He'd been after deer. It was just Loring's bad luck that Dylan had run into him instead.
You ever been to Muskingum County before? Maybe just driving around. Not a whole lot of us, probably. I didn't go there. You know, I just headed up there. I don't know. I just started going west. Just headed up there.
Detective Mike Workema does acknowledge there are certain similarities between some of Dylan's crimes and the murders at the Fulton Game area.
That's extremely coincidental, but these are the kind of things that happen in investigations, and now these are some of the obstacles that we have to overcome to get a conviction.
But according to Detective Workema, even if the cold case team had known about the serial killer, they'd have found a way to get past that, so they'd still be able to convict Jeff Titus. But why didn't the cold case team know about Tom Dylan? They'd spent 2.5 years investigating this case and interviewed hundreds of people in connection with that case. So how is it possible this whole serial killer thing never came up? There had at one time been reports in the case file from detectives Rosima and Van Strain that documented their investigation into Dylan back in 1993. But those reports are all missing. And it's at least theoretically possible they went missing before the cold case team ever got a chance to see the case file. So, the cold case team never knew about them. But there is someone else in this case who knew about Tom Dylan. Helen Knopfs, the witness who'd picked him out of the lineup. And the cold case team did speak to her. So, she could have told them about the serial killer.
Did anyone from that cold case team come to talk to you at that time then, before the trial?
Oh, yeah. Detective from the cold case team, I think he was head of it, I do not remember his name. He came to my house to talk to me about Jeff, and he was quite obnoxious. He asked me if Jeff had ever threatened me, and I said no. So he said, well, I can find 100 people that'll tell you that Jeff has threatened them. And I said, well, then maybe you should go talk to them, because I don't know what you're talking about. He had obviously made up his mind that Jeff was the one that had done this.
Because Tom Dylan was never seriously investigated as a potential suspect in the Fulton Gay Maria murders, there was a lot of evidence that could potentially link him to the crime that had been overlooked by investigators. But it also means that evidence that could have excluded him as a suspect was also never really considered either. And there is evidence that suggests that Tom Dylan did not commit the murders in Kalamazoo. There are two pieces of evidence in particular that stand out as problems for the Tom Dylan theory. The first is that Kathy Dylan's Chevy Cavalier had been registered in Ohio.
When I learned later that there was maybe some suspicion of someone from Ohio having done this, I knew for sure the car was not from Ohio, because I'm from Ohio, and if the plates had been Ohio plates, that would have jumped out to me.
When Helen Knopf saw the ditch car, it had been nose down in the ditch with its back bumper up and visible. It had been around sunset at the time, so there was still ample light out. The ditch car's plates should have been visible. And Helen Knopf says that if she'd seen Ohio plates in the ditch car, that's something she would have remembered. And to me, this is the single most important fact that points away from Dylan's involvement in the Kalamazoo case. But at the same time, Helen does not have an affirmative memory of seeing Michigan plates in the ditch car. Instead, she believes, reasonably, that if the car had Ohio plates, she would have noticed it. And it's likely that she would have, but it's also not certain that she would have. Not certain enough anyway where Dylan could be eliminated based on that alone.
The second piece of evidence that points away from Dylan's involvement in the Kalamazoo case is the buck that he shot that morning while hunting at the Ravenna Arsenal. What happened to that buck after he left the arsenal? The only clue we have comes from an order form from an Ohio butcher requesting processing of the deer shot in Ravenna. It's dated November 17, 1990, and Tom Dylan is listed as the customer. There's no time listed for when the deer was dropped off, just the date, and a note that the deer was paid for and picked up on November 25th. If Tom Dylan dropped the buck off at the butcher after leaving Ravenna, then that would have severely cut into the time he had to make the drive to the Fulton game area. Without the trip to the butcher, Dylan could have made the drive to Fulton with an hour and a half to spare before the murders. But with the detour to the butcher added in, Dylan's timeline becomes razor thin, much like the drive that the cold case team claims that Jeff Titus made that day to commit the murders, from the Shepherd Farm to the game area and back again. The drive Dylan would have had to make might not be impossible, but it would certainly be implausible. So the receipt from the butcher is important evidence, but again, by itself, it's short of being conclusive. For one thing, there's a document which might be able to resolve this entire question one way or the other, and that's the record of Dylan's entrance onto the Ravenna Arsenal complex on the morning of the hunt. This record should confirm whether it was truly Dylan who was at the complex that day and what vehicle he was driving at the time. In the records we obtained from Ohio, there's indeed a letter from an Arsenal official that says the entrance records are being mailed to the task force. But if the task force ever did receive those records, it's not clear where they are now. They weren't present in the files of any agency we've been able to get records from.
We also know that Dylan has not always been truthful about what happened at the Ravenna hunt. He told two different co-workers that it had been their gun that he'd used to kill the buck there that day, and he'd been lying to at least one of them. In his videotaped confession, Dylan's never asked about his alibi for the Kalamazoo murders, but he was asked about events that led up to the murder of Kevin Loring, who was shot 11 days after the Fulton game area murders, on November 28, 1990.
So when you left that house that morning, you were going deer hunting. You had no idea who could kill anybody like that?
No.
I lived here in the mountains. I just came back from Pennsylvania the day before.
Well, why did you come back then? I
came back. I had to fill my tag in Ohio still. But I hadn't gotten one in a while. I had a double tag in here.
From November 25th to 27th, Dylan had been in Pennsylvania on a deer hunting trip with some of his friends. Dylan had ended up cutting the trip short, though, and drove back to Ohio on the 27th. It was on the following day that Kevin Loring was shot and killed. In his confession tape, Dylan starts to tell the investigators that he'd come back from Pennsylvania on the 27th because he had not yet filled his tag in Ohio that year. Which isn't true, because we have a deer harvest record that shows Dylan's tag had been filled out with the buck at Ravenna. But then Dylan corrects himself. He wanted to fill his second tag in Ohio, he says. But this too is a lie. There were no double tags in Ohio in 1990. Ohio didn't begin double tags until the following year, in 91. In 1990, Dylan had a single tag for a single buck, and according to that record that the Ohio Task Force found, Dylan used that tag at Ravenna. None of the investigators seem to notice that what Dylan is saying here about the second tag can't be true. But one of the investigators does have a follow-up question, because in 91 and 92, when second tags had been issued, the second tag had always been limited to a single county.
Where was the second tag for?
There's typically like county
Tuscarawas.
Is it Tuscarawas or Carroll? They have a Tuscarawas out there shooting Carroll and tagging another county. Yeah, I asked for Carroll, but I might not have gotten it. I don't know. It didn't make any difference anyway.
I don't know. It doesn't make any difference anyway, Dylan says. And the task force drops the line of questioning. And sure, maybe it really didn't make a difference why Dylan was telling this weird lie about an imaginary second deer tag. But when a serial killer starts telling weird lies that impact his alibi for double homicide, maybe we shouldn't be taking his word about what does and doesn't matter anyway.
So See, the one thing about Dylan that you have to understand is he did not want to be put to death. You know, if he told us things that were not accurate in the interviews, we would have scrapped the plea agreement and he would have been death penalty eligible. So he had a lot to lose. And so I tend to believe what he's saying. He's been consistent.
If Tom Dylan had decided to go to trial, he would not have been convicted on 3 of the 5 murder charges that he ended up pleading guilty to. There just had not been enough evidence. But Dylan would almost certainly have been convicted for 2 of the murders, and that was enough to get him the death penalty.
Lucky they don't have phones at death row. For the reason of doing this, I would never have done this. I wouldn't care.
In conversations with reporters and attorneys and investigators, Dylan often claimed that it wasn't the death penalty itself that he was afraid of. And on this, and maybe this alone, I think I actually believe Dylan's telling the truth here. It was all the restrictions the death row came with that he was desperate to avoid.
It was to his benefit to tell us about everything that he was involved in.
The credibility of Dylan's confession had also been bolstered by the fact that it was consistent with the profile. The task force and the FBI's behavioral science unit had previously identified 5 cases, the murders of Welling, Paxton, Loring, Hawkins, and Bradley, and linked them together as being the probable work of a single serial killer.
And it was those 5 cases that Dylan ultimately pled to. And I find it interesting that y'all identified the 5 cases and all the 5 cases that Dylan did. Did you ever wonder if your parameters were too small or too big, or how confident were you that those 5 were the 5 going into this?
How confident were we that we linked the right ones together? I mean, we were very confident. And as it turned out, we were right. It turned out to be Dylan. And I mean, he gave us detailed information about each and every case. So clearly we were right on which ones he did.
I want to emphasize something here about the timing of all this. This profile was developed over the spring of 1992, after investigators had come to believe that an unknown serial killer was targeting outdoorsmen in Ohio. These 5 cases had been linked together before the task force went public in August of 92, and before Tom Dylan's friend Richard Fry had submitted his name to the task force in September of 92. Which means this profile had been based solely on the characteristics of the murders themselves. It wasn't based on anything having to do with Tom Dylan, because at that point in time, the task force had no idea who Tom Dylan was. And maybe the task force got it right here. Maybe that profile was so accurate that they were able to correctly predict every murder a serial killer had committed, even before they knew for certain that a serial killer existed. But it's also possible that this profile became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Tom Dylan confessed to those 5 murders because those were the 5 murders that the profile said he committed. Therefore, it was those 5 murders that Dylan had to confess to in order to avoid the death penalty. But Agent Trombitis says that if there had been any more murders beyond the 5, Dylan would have had motivation to confess to those too.
He fancied himself as, you know, really a one-of-a-kind individual, and that he was doing things that nobody else really was doing. And he seemed to take great pride in that. Dylan, if there was a way to increase his numbers, have people think that he killed 8 people or 9 people, I think he would have gone for it.
In his conversations with reporters, Dylan never seemed particularly fixated on the number of kills he had, but he did often boast about how unique the crimes he committed had been.
He told me that most serial killers, men anyways, kill women. He has chosen 5 men as his victims. That is an odd occurrence to his knowledge anyway.
But I think he enjoyed being unlike other serial killers.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Smaldon, the forensic psychologist that was hired by Dylan's defense team.
I remember in one of our conversations, he said he was sort of offended by this whole notion of profiling, as though somehow he could be captured in some profiler's box. And he just said, you know, what do they do if you start varying your MO and very consciously behave differently than their analysis of your prior behavior suggests you will? So he was intrigued by this idea of being able to operate outside, you know, the knowledge base of these people who consider themselves experts. Yeah, and I never, I mean, I always sort of regretted that that case resolved as quickly as it did, just from my perspective as a forensic psychologist, because had it dragged on longer, I would have sought out more collateral interviews, but the plea agreement came about pretty quickly.
In his conversations with Dr. Smalden, Dylan had never tried to deny that he committed the five murders he pled guilty to.
He obviously took pleasure in, you know, killing just about anything he came upon, and he would drive long distances out in the country. And like a lot of serial killers, he was sort of gamey in his way of interacting. He would parcel out information, you know, in little bits to sort of see how much you knew before he let you know how much he knew.
Dylan was not criminally insane. He had been calculating and deliberate in how he committed his offenses, though he often tried to downplay just how intentional his crimes had been.
And, you know, obviously he was mobile in the sense that he made a deliberate attempt. He always kind of made it sound like, you know, he would just drive around and these things would just kind of happen randomly. But I think he was very conscious of committing these murders in different jurisdictions and kind of confounding the authorities that way, making it harder for them to link their investigations together in sort of a Bundy-esque kind of killer on the roam way.
Yeah, he seemed to have a fascination with Bundy in particular.
He did. Bundy was sort of perfectly camouflaged in that he was handsome, he was articulate, he had good social skills, and Dylan aspired to being able to be that effectively camouflaged himself.
Tom Dylan was fascinated by all serial killers and kept a personal library of books about them. But according to Dylan's best friend, Richard Fry, he'd had almost a personal attachment to Ted Bundy. It was Bundy that he had the most books about, and Bundy that he most frequently brought up in conversation. Dylan had even started drinking Mickey's Big Mouth Malt Liquor because that had been Ted Bundy's favorite kind of beer. Thomas Lee Dylan was an extremely dangerous man, and by his own admission, he would have killed again. But given the nature of the crimes he was committing, the evidence against him could be thin. This was not an easy case to resolve.
You know, the whole goal was to get the truth out and to be able to hold Dylan accountable for what he did. He did some terrible things, and he needed to spend at least the rest of his life in prison.
Given the difficulties of the case, what the task force achieved may have been the optimal outcome available here. But in order to get that outcome, the task force hadn't been able to dwell too long on the dozens of cases for which Dylan had been floated as a possible suspect. A lot of those cases today remain unsolved or questionably solved. And some of them I can't help but wonder about. Some of them, I wonder if it could have been Dylan after all. There's the deer hunter in Indiana, shot in a field 80 miles south of the Fulton game area. The woman shot with a high-powered rifle while jogging on a remote country road, killed in exactly the same way that Donald Welling would be 8 years later. The turkey hunter in southern Ohio, shot in the back with double-aught buck just a month after the last murder that Dylan confessed to committing. The deer hunter in Pennsylvania, killed 5 miles from a cabin where Dylan would stay while on hunting trips there.
Believe it or not, there's stuff like this that happens a lot, but not every case is Dylan. And, you know, there are other people out there that commit these things.
Agent Trombitis is right. Not all of these cases can be Dylan. And Dylan is not responsible for every unsolved murder of an outdoorsman in or around Ohio. But also, if some of these cases actually were Dylan, we wouldn't know. Because once Dylan denied responsibility, the investigation into him was dropped.
In addition to the unsolved homicides of several hunters in Ohio and neighboring states, there were also several non-fatal shootings that Dylan had been a suspect in. For instance, on the morning of July 21st, 1992, two men hunting in Dillon State Park reported that a man in a red truck, the same kind of truck that Dillon would have been driving in 1992, had pulled over, gotten out of his vehicle, and pointed a rifle in their direction. When the man in the red truck became aware that the two hunters had spotted him, he got back in his truck and left.
Do you recall the 7/21/92 shooting, or shooting attempted?
Oh, were they the two firemen? Yeah. Yeah, no, it wasn't him.
How do you know? What was he?
Well, again, you know, based on, we talked to him about, did you ever, he said, first of all, I would never go after two people. He doesn't have the nerve to try to take on two people.
A similar incident occurred just a few months later, on October 16th, 1992. Larry Oler had been out hunting in Tuscarawas County when a man in a small gray Chevy with square taillights flat along its trunk pulled over, got out, and started shooting at him. The man had missed his shot, though, and Larry was able to escape and take cover in a creekside embankment. When the task force later showed pictures of Dillon's Chevy Cavalier to Larry Oler, he identified it as the same car that the man who had shot at him had been driving.
We can't pin every case on Dillon. You know, again, when you got a guy that's telling you he's taking responsibility for five homicides and one attempted homicide, and he's telling you that he never fired at anybody, never missed, he would never go after two people.
In his taped video confession, Dillon admitted to all five of the homicides that he was being asked to plead guilty to. He denied ever killing anyone else beyond those five. But he did give the task force investigators one freebie.
1980, in Tuscarawas County, I wounded somebody. I shot somebody with him. So I was groundhog hunting all day that night, right about dusk. So this guy was back to the picture window of his house, sitting on the sofa. So this thought came to me. He said, stop, back up, and shoot this guy. So I shot at him through the picture window. I read the paper the next day, the bullet fragmented, and it hit him in the back.
We didn't even know anything about the 1980 case until he told us about it. So,
and that's one that wasn't even on your radar.
Wasn't even on our radar.
Tom Dillon lived just 5 minutes away from where Wesley Tuck had been shot and nearly killed. But if Dillon hadn't confessed to this crime, investigators would have never linked him to it. It didn't match the profile. After all, Tom Dillon is the Ohio outdoorsman sniper, not the Ohio picture window shooter. And this shooting also deviated from Dillon's profile in another significant way. It took place nearly a decade before any of the other murders that Dillon confessed to.
What did you do between 1980, though, and...
My wife said, you know, how could that be that 9 years you didn't do anything? And I said, it's probably because Johnny was born, our son. He was born in December of 80, and I was really involved in his care when he was younger, and for 5 or 6 years, that's probably what kept me occupied. Well, kept me from going off the deep end, I don't know.
He really quiet for 9 years, though.
He wasn't quiet. That's the thing you got to remember. He was committing arsons, animal killings. He did have the birth of his son in that. So, I mean, there was something there. So he wasn't quiet. He was vandalizing. He was doing all these things. So, you know, the fact that for whatever reason, he was able to control himself and not shoot anybody else. There's always a little bit of doubt in us that maybe that was the case, but we can't prove it otherwise.
I know for like a lot of there were a lot of murders they were looking at him for they never really pursued, and they did rule them out because of the profile.
That would seem like a mistake to me. And someone like Dillon, very conscious of wanting to operate outside the lines.
In all five of the murders that Dillon confessed to, the victims had been men. And a number of people who'd known Dillon told me that Dillon had told them this was not a coincidence.
What's interesting, though, is when I talked to the reporter, she said that Dillon had assured her he'd never kill a woman.
Yeah, I just remember him... Somebody asked him a question about what would you have done if it was a woman, and him saying it wouldn't have made any difference to me.
Dylan had to have been lying to someone here, but was he lying to the reporters when he claimed he'd never kill a woman, or was he lying to the task force when he claimed it made no difference to him if the person he killed was a woman or a man? Based on the glimpses we have into Dylan's private and unguarded conversations, I think the answer could be that he was lying to both. That he would have killed a woman, and that it would have made a difference to him. It was Tom Dylan's childhood friend Richard Fry who turned Dylan's name in to the task force. And during the investigation into Dylan, the task force had asked Fry to wear a wire to try and talk to his friend about the murders, and Fry had agreed. One weekend, the two of them had hopped into Dylan's Chevy Cavalier and driven up to Cleveland for a gun show. On the way there, Fry had coaxed Dylan into talking about a number of unsolved crimes in the area.
Fry had a wire on him when he was speaking to Dylan. Right. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah.
And at one point, he's talking about a prostitute who was killed in Canton. Does that ring a bell at all? I think Fry asked about him. Fry's like, remember that prostitute you keep talking about that was killed? He's like, yeah, the one who strangled that strip mine off of this road here. Or he's like, the black one who strangled on the strip mine here. And I'm like, that seems like a lot of... He's very familiar with this case. And then Fry asks if he kills her. And he's like, yeah, I did. Which seems worth following up on. I don't know.
Based on what context can be gleaned from the transcript of his conversation with Fry, Dylan does seem to have been joking here, at least to some degree. When Dylan began talking about the woman whose body was found in the strip mine, Fry had pointed out that Dylan was contradicting himself, that he'd previously made a different claim about what had happened to her. To which Dylan had responded, "All right, I just strangled her." Fry then asked him, "Did you strangle her?" And Dylan said, "You know, yeah." It's not really a joke, and it's definitely not funny, but in context, it reads more like a sarcastic quip than a genuine confession. Still, it's a disturbing comment coming from anyone, and more alarming still when it's coming from an admitted serial killer. Especially one who frequently talked to reporters about his obsession with sex workers.
Dylan admits spending most of his adult life in a drunken stupor, working as a draftsman in the Canyon Water Department, a job that he said would have bored any. Lunch hours were often spent cruising downtown Canton for prostitutes. Dylan said that he was on a perpetual sex binge and that he was with 18 different prostitutes last year alone. Getting a prostitute is easy, it's quick, and you don't have to take her to dinner, Dylan said. Plus, it's guaranteed results every time.
In a series of articles about her months of phone calls with Tom Dylan, the reporter at the Akron Beacon Journal had documented a number of claims that Dylan had made about sex workers. And one of the most startling of these claims is the following.
Dylan says that authorities have interviewed all the hookers he had sex with in Canton, about 11, and that none of them said that he was violent. It amazes him that the authorities were so thorough.
The reason this claim is startling is that I'm pretty sure Dylan made the whole thing up. Those interviews didn't happen. There are no records I've been able to uncover that would suggest any sex workers in Canton were ever interviewed about Dylan. Agent Trombitis does recall, though, that Dylan had been very interested in this particular topic.
There were times that he went up to, like, Cleveland and some of those areas. I mean, he very well could have gone to prostitutes and things like that. But once it was clear that he was not going to be hunting, you know, we didn't follow him around. You know, the chances of him going back down and hunting, you know, people, victims being out in the woods were pretty slight. But it's ironic that you asked that because when we were talking to Dylan about, you know, the surveillance of him and that, and he was just like blown away that we followed him and I was showing him some of these pictures that we took and that. And he asked me one time, he said, "Did you talk to any of those prostitutes I was with?" And I said, I just smiled like maybe I did. He goes, "Hopefully they said I was the best ever." And I just laughed and, you know, I mean, I didn't acknowledge that we didn't or you know, I didn't talk to Trixie or whoever it was. I just, you know, let him believe that I said, "Tom, there's a lot of stuff we know." He was adamant. He wanted to know what the prostitute said about him.
Maybe Dylan had been so concerned about what these women had told the task force because he just really wanted to know if they'd given him good reviews. But there's another reason I can think of, too, for why a serial killer would be so concerned about what investigators had discovered about him. And that's if he had other crimes that he wanted to hide.
I mean, he certainly fantasized about killing women. I think he said that his recurring fantasy was killing the prostitute who he frequented most.
And Dr. Smalden says that Dylan described having violent fantasies about all kinds of things. He often thought about blowing up bridges or shooting up a school that was predominantly attended by Black children.
I think he was pretty racist.
He had neo-Nazi subscriptions. So
did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, I don't think.
So yeah, he subscribed to like a neo-Nazi newsletter.
Huh. But I mean, I never got the sense from him that he would have considered patronizing a African-American prostitute.
Oh, they were all mostly Black.
Were the ones that he went to?
Yeah.
Because the police never investigated Dylan's relationship with sex workers, what we know about this comes mostly from Dylan's friends, who told investigators about Dylan's habit of, quote, picking up Black hookers in Akron. And then there's that reporter from the Akron Beacon Journal, the one who spent months talking to Dylan. In her very last installment, she summarized one of the final phone calls with Dylan, in which he'd began talking to her about a time when she'd come to see him in jail to interview him in person.
Dylan said that when I visited him after the arraignment, he had the urge to strangle me. Yep, he said, if it hadn't been for Deputy Smith and her 357, I would have. Really, I asked him? Yeah, he said.
Tom Dylan loved to brag about what a special unicorn snowflake he was, a straight male serial killer who only killed men. But I'm not convinced that Dylan was as unusual as he'd like to claim. And I've wondered, is it possible he was killing women too? When I raised this possibility to some of the people who worked on this case, they assured me that nothing like that had happened. After all, the profile says that Tom Dylan is a coward, and cowards don't have the ability to kill up close. Dylan would never have been able to strangle someone because it's just too personal of a crime. According to Dr. Smalden, though, Dylan would likely have disagreed with this assessment.
When he was criticizing sort of the whole profiling enterprise, he would say, you know, what if a killer just decided to defy the profile altogether and just adopt a completely different MO? Like, wouldn't that just fuck with the heads of those people?
Dylan was excluded as a suspect in every case that he did not confess to.
I just can't imagine that, you know, he would have any reason to not want to take credit for those things.
Yeah, it's true. Like, at that point,
Indiana had death penalty.
Well, that's true.
It wasn't just Indiana, either. Pennsylvania had the death penalty, too. Michigan did not, but if Dylan had started confessing to murders outside of Ohio, he would have risked attracting the attention of a prosecutor from one of the death penalty states. And Dylan's plea deal in Ohio would not have covered any crimes that he'd committed elsewhere. So Dylan had lots of reasons not to take credit for any murders outside of Ohio. His access to phones and TV and visits with his wife and son all depended on him not taking credit. Still, just because Dylan had a very good reason to decline credit doesn't mean that he wouldn't have wanted that credit. And in the records we received from one of the agencies in Ohio, there were four pages of handwritten notes that, when I saw them, immediately caught my eye. The notes are sketchy and incomplete, but they're from an interview that the FBI conducted with someone that I'm going to call Mike. And in March of 1993, Mike had been in the Lake County Jail with Tom Dylan. I finally tracked down a number for what I thought might be Mike's workplace, so I called and ended up leaving a message with one of his coworkers. I said I was looking for a Mike who'd once known someone named Tom Dylan. 10 minutes later, Mike called me back.
My buddy just came up. He goes, yeah, somebody just called about a Tom Dylan. And I go, Tom Dylan? I said, dude, that guy was like a serial killer or something. And he goes, and I just told him, I said, yeah, I was in the hole with him. And he used to brag to me about killing people.
Yep, this was definitely the Mike I'd been looking for.
And I'm looking into the murder of a hunter.
Oh, well, he told me about the hunter. Mm-hmm. I was in prison and I got into a fight and Tom was in PC, protective custody, in the cell next to me. Mm-hmm. And he started telling me all this psycho stuff. And he shot How did it go? He was walking in the woods and there was a hunter. There was two hunters. There were two people in the woods, actually. There was two guys that were hunting, if I remember right. It's just been so long.
He told you about two guys being shot in the woods.
Yes.
In 1992, Mike was arrested for growing marijuana. It was his first offense, and he ended up being sentenced to 8 years in prison. Before sentencing, though, he'd been held at the Lake County Jail, and after ending up in the hole, he'd found himself with a new next-door neighbor, Tom Dillon.
He seemed so normal. I remember telling my parents about it, that I met this guy, and he's, you'd never know it. My big thing is I call, like anybody that does something like, I see, they look like an insurance salesman, you know, normal.
While they were in the hole together, Mike and his new neighbor began talking.
And we used to play chess through the trap.
Was he good at chess?
No, actually, he wasn't. He was too busy talking about himself.
Mm-hmm. It didn't take long for Mike to realize, however, that normal Tom, his new chess buddy, was not at all normal.
He was telling me, he goes, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I used to go to the dump up the street and I used to shoot rats. And, you know, then there was cats there, so I'd shoot the cats. And, you know, who doesn't like to do that? He goes, and then, you know, when you get tired of doing that, then, you know, I mean, it's like it was a normal progression to just start shooting people, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, this guy's nuts.
Mike says that Tom also seemed disturbingly optimistic that he would be able to go home soon.
They can't prove it. They don't got me, you know, stuff like that. I'm going to beat this, you know.
Well, he did not.
Yeah. No, I just Googled him. He died in, what was it, 2011?
Yeah, he's been dead for a while.
Mike told his attorney about the kind of stuff Tom had been telling him, and his attorney ended up contacting the FBI. A few weeks later, two FBI agents showed up at the Lake County Jail.
The FBI, who was it? The FBI came to see me about it.
That's how I got your name.
They were real kind of cavalier about it. You know what I mean?
Mike told the FBI agents everything that he'd heard from Tom, including about the two hunters that Tom said he'd killed. But the FBI agents had seemed bored and hadn't asked many questions.
Yeah, they were very, they saw me one time for, I don't even know, you know, a half hour at best. And then I never heard any more about it.
Anytime there's a jailhouse informant, skepticism is warranted. But what I don't understand is the FBI's complete disinterest in Mike's story. Because some of the stuff Mike knew was clearly coming straight from Tom Dillon himself. It couldn't have come from anywhere else.
He was at work. He was some kind of a city worker or something. And he would be driving around while he was supposed to be working. He would be out burning buildings down. And he used to do something with his records because he said they couldn't get them because he was at work.
Mike says that Tom told him he'd been able to falsify his work record somehow, to make it look like he'd been at his job at the Canton Waterworks when in reality he'd been out driving around committing arsons. But that is not a claim that appears anywhere in the various case files I've seen. In fact, what Mike says Dillon told him is the exact opposite of what's in the case files. The task force had thought that the work records were reliable and used them to exclude him from any crimes that were committed while he was on the clock.
Okay, now you're sure you did this, Barn?
Yeah.
Leave that one because I checked it. That's one of the first things I checked.
I did this one. Your records are wrong.
Hopper, and your work schedule says you were that you didn't.
I know I did that one.
There was a woman. I remember something about a woman was going because Dillon was happy that he didn't shoot a woman because unbeknownst to him that he was under surveillance. And he turned around, there was a woman jogging down the road or something. And he was going to shoot her, and then he just backed out of it, and here there was an airplane following him at that particular time.
Agent Trombitis had once asked Tom Dillon about this jogger as well, though Dillon had given Trombitis a very different answer.
Did you ask him about the jogger?
Yes. He didn't remember. No.
He didn't remember.
No.
Or he didn't admit.
He told about that.
Really?
Yeah, he was like, he told me that.
Here's the thing about Mike, and I don't know. I don't remember if I ever talked to him or not. I don't think I did. But there's some guys that like to talk a lot, you know, and they're always looking for a little help in that. So that, I mean, I'm not saying he's being dishonest or anything. I'm just saying that you know, at some point it doesn't make sense. And, you know, Dylan probably talked to him about the Michigan cases because we told him that, I mean, if we wouldn't have talked to Dylan about him, assuming he didn't do it, which I'm assuming he didn't, he wouldn't have known anything about the Kalamazoo cases. So it was the fact that we talked to him and asked him questions about it that he takes that back to Mike.
He was definitely talking to Dylan because the notes show stuff that he
could not. I don't doubt that he talked to Dylan. I don't, you know, I just can tell you that anything that was said that came to our attention was followed up.
Mike must have heard these things from Tom Dylan, but the question is, where did Tom Dylan hear them from? Because Mike's conversations with Dylan took place about a month after the lineup in Coshocton County, Ohio. And as a result of the lineup, Dylan would have heard all about the murders at the Fulton Game area, either from his own attorneys or directly from Agent Trombitus himself.
Did he describe how he did it?
No. He shot him, but he never talked about the caliber or the gun or anything. No. But he said hello to him like they were, you know, hey, how you doing kind of thing. And then he shot him.
While the information Dylan shared with Mike was disturbing, it was also nonspecific. He did not give Mike the kind of information that could rule out the possibility of a false confession. Dylan did not give names or locations or dates. What he told Mike does not show that he had genuine first-person knowledge about how the crimes occurred. But what it does show is that Tom Dylan, the serial killer who hunted hunters, had indeed wanted to take credit for the murders in Kalamazoo.
Let's see.
The big thing was the two hunters in the woods. Because he prattled on about that, you know, because it was a, what did he call it, the double header with the hunters.
I don't know if Tom Dylan is responsible for the murders of Jim Bennett and Doug Estes. I have deep doubts about every possible answer to this question. What I do feel confident about is that if Jeff Titus's attorneys had known about Tom Dylan and they'd been capable of raising a competent defense, Jeff Titus almost certainly would not have been convicted. Tom Dylan is reasonable doubt. But Jeff Titus's attorneys did not know about Dylan. Jeff is currently represented by the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan, and his attorney, Professor Dave Moran, learned about Dylan for the very first time last year when I called and told him about him. After hearing about Dylan, Professor Moran made a trip down to the Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department so he could review the case file. And while going through the file there at the sheriff's office, he came across a manila folder that the defense had never seen before. On the little folder tab, someone had written the word serial killer, and inside was a collection of documents about Tom Dylan and about the ditch car. This file did not contain any of Detective Orsima's reports about Tom Dylan. Those are still missing. But it did have other records on Dylan, including records that had been faxed over from the Coshocton County Sheriff's Department and interviews with witnesses who had seen the ditch car and the ditch man. Which means that someone on the cold case team did know about the serial killer. Someone on the cold case team had to have assembled that manila folder and written serial killer there on the file label. So I guess Tom Dylan was one of those obstacles that the cold case team was able to overcome in order to get their conviction. That's all for episode 14 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Jeff Titus. Don't miss our addendum this Thursday to answer all of your questions about Thomas Lee Dylan. And we're back on Monday with the penultimate episode in our series on the case of Jeff Titus. Also, if you want to hear more from my interview with Mike, check out the Killer in Question episode on Jeff's case on Discovery ID if you haven't already. Amethal Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo was designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez. Audio production was done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and host of the Crime Writers On podcast. And music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Transcripts for episodes are available on our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. They're brought to you by our amazing transcript team, Dom Logis, Britta Bliss, Skylar Park, and Erica Fladell. And of course, thank you to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. You can follow us online, and on all social media, our handle is at UndisclosedPod. We're at Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any of our listeners out there have information on Jeff Titus's case that they'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com, or you can call and leave a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.